La 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 la.
If you want to hear your favorite technical news, give the Gizmo Gang a call. They talk megabytes to petabytes and cover it all. They're the Gizmo Sapiens. They're the Gizmo Sapiens.
Welcome to Gizmo Sapiens Show 103, and today with me is Matt Hurley, who is a freelance journalist who most recently wrote an article on civil forfeiture in New Mexico and their new civil forfeiture law. And welcome, Matt.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And today we're going to talk about social innovation in technology. And so a lot of people probably don't realize what this is. It's a market. Social innovation is a marketing term, just like many technological terms like cloud and infrastructure as a service and those types of things. But it's a little bit more insidious than the actual term social innovation thinks about. And what it is social innovation technologies typically are solutions that are supposed to make life easier. So a good example of a socially innovative technology is a smart car that can be monitored by satellite. If somebody steals it, they can turn your car off, keep it safe. But on the flip side, socially innovative technologies could also be abused and used to erode your freedoms and stop you from being able to protect your freedoms. So that's kind of what we're going to talk about today, mainly because I don't think it's talked about enough.
No, it really isn't. But then again, civil liberties outside of the racial arena with police officers, civil liberties is really not a topic that gets a whole lot of spotlight, really.
Yeah. Well, and the problem is so probably the most pervasive social innovation technology out there are red light cameras. You know, and who likes red light cameras? They're not accurate. They don't take into account that you may, which you do have the legal right, if you were within an intersection and it light turns red, you have the right of way to go through. But a red light camera does not see it that way. It is a black and white system. And so, you know, then you have to go to the fact that you're fighting a ticket. We found that in many places, red light cameras are not being used legally, and so they've taken them out. Luckily, Ohio is in places have slowly been taking them out. And
well, in Ohio, it's actually the state legislature passed a law requiring that an officer be on site when a red light camera is used, and two municipalities have appealed that. Toledo is one of them, Dayton is the other, and I think that's still going to be
it's going to be an issue for a while.
Quite a while yet.
But, you know, some of the other innovative technologies or social innovation technologies out there are, and I'm quite sure most people don't realize this, so companies buy cloud-based security systems, you know, for storefronts, jewelry stores, local business on the corner. It's all downtown. So I'm going to use Dayton, Ohio as an example because what most people don't know is that the police departments across the United States also subscribe to that same social innovation or cloud-based service. And so when they're tracking criminals, they have access to every one of those security cameras from the businesses. They have access to all of the cameras that are part of your red light camera system. And so basically it's a surveillance state just like England.
Don't forget, anytime you go through an intersection now, there's surveillance cameras in most municipalities now anyway. Even though they're not necessarily ticketable cameras, they are surveillance cameras.
Yeah, absolutely. absolutely. And, you know, and some of it, it on the surface, it seems, and probably 90% of the use is beneficial to society. These systems do gunshot detection, so they can correlate if there is an unreported gunshot, a car crash. They do car wreck or noise detection. You know, and the concept is that this technology is something for good. But on the flip side, what's to say that, you know, somebody, a judge, somebody issues a warrant that says that they can use that system to track an individual?
Well, as I was reading the material you sent me to prep for this, the movie, the Tom Cruise movie Minority Report, came to my consciousness a lot.
Yeah.
Because here's a situation where technology has become so infallible in its perception that when it gets perverted by the state, it becomes an evil itself.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's, I think, while these companies don't necessarily intend their technology to be perverted in such a way, that there's nobody asking the question, they're asking the wrong question. They're asking the question, can we do this? Whereas the question is, should we do this?
Yeah.
And I don't think enough companies have as much forethought to ask the right question.
Well, and, you know, I would say that probably the two, from a holistic system, there's only two. It's kind of funny. Most people don't realize this because you just don't think about it. When you go to Walmart, you buy the goods and services that are there, or you go to Target or whatever, you're not really thinking about who makes all those products, how those products can work into it. And there are many social companies into social innovation. Apple, Google, Microsoft, you know, all the ones we think about, people who make cell phones, because, you know, cell phones can have GPS tracking, whatever. You kind of understand, though, when you buy a cell phone, that you can be tracked by it. And criminals know today that one great way to not be tracked by your cell phone is to go to Walmart, buy a burner phone, and, you know, disable the GPS, and, you know, so that they have to do the hard things like use radio triangulation to figure out, you know, if they can even figure out which phone you're on. But, you know, it's one of those things where I, as a consumer, I'm making the choice that I'm going to give up a little bit of privacy for the convenience to carry this. But a lot of the other social innovation companies like Hitachi Limited and General Electric, who I will call frenemies, because not only are they're each other's only competitor in the world from a corporate standpoint, because they make everything. They make Hitachi Limited. This is the funniest thing in the world. Their largest product or best-selling product that they ship more of every year is called the Hitachi Magic Wand. It is a personal vibration device, and you can see it and read the reviews on Amazon to understand what most people use them for. But they also make bullet trains. They make fusion nuclear reactors. GE is in the same boat. And as frenemies, they team together to do other systems. So one of the other big social innovation technologies out there is in healthcare. You know, so you know, we talk about this concept of cradle to grave medical records for kids born for the last 10 years.
But it's not just medical records, because now they're doing education as well. So it starts in pre-kindergarten.
Correct.
And you know, all those test scores and all the questions that they're asking. How many stories have we heard about the Common Core educational standards where and really the whole curriculum has been perverted into data mining?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and that's a big part of it is, you know, what kind of data can we extract? You know, both GE and Hitachi Limited have made big investments into the whole big data analytics. Hitachi Limited, one of their subsidiaries just bought a company called Pentaho, who that's all they do is data analytics and ETL. So they're, you know, transferring and taking mining data from other systems like, you know, traditional databases and data archives and combining all that with the analytics that they created. And why are they doing that? Well, part of it is for good. You know, I apply data analytics. I anonymize all my data in my medical storage that I have for hundreds and thousands and millions of records. And I then look at trends and see, you know, I correlate the fact that so-and-so smoked for 15 years and they now have a higher risk of cancer. We're seeing, you know, 52% cancer rate in a bunch of people who smoked for the same period of time. That seems great. But what about now that I have access and have all this stuff about job discrimination? You know, well, you smoked for 10 years, so we can't cover you on insurance, so, you know, you can't be employed here. You know, I mean,
those types of cases have come up, although Obamacare kind of negates some of that, theoretically.
Theoretically.
In reality, I think the reality is very different, I think.
Very much so. But, you know, it's that what we talk about. I mean, it's easy to go, and I'll a good example is something, I don't know if you're even aware of this, because this just came up. So, everybody knows Radio Shack went bankrupt.
Right.
And so, they have the IP, or the asset, which is the only asset left of Radio Shack, was bought by a hedge fund.
Yeah. And so, the reason why is what I think is interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah, and the reason why is they want to mine all that data.
Exactly.
That's the IP. Well, come to find out, Microsoft, Google, and Apple, who are much more interested in protecting people's rights because they don't want them to quit using their devices, each of them have a separate lawsuit saying that the data that Radio Shack has is not Radio Shack's data regarding their specific customers. Apple just filed theirs today, and theirs is probably the most promising of the three. But it's going to affect the value of the IP that's left for Radio Shack because it's the data that was valuable, not the minuscule assets that were rest of the – everything else was worthless essentially. So the inventory, you know, the thing that Radio Shack actually did, which was have stores and we sell product, all of that is worthless. It's only the data that the hedge fund wants, you know. And so what is that data being used for? And that's why both Microsoft, Google, and Apple are all asking, saying that, well, wait a minute, that's our data. That hedge fund can't use that data.
And their argument is that it's our products.
Well, it's not actually – Apple, right. Apple had, as part of the resale agreement, it actually says the data is Apple's data. It's their customer data.
Really?
Yes, and Radio Shack agreed to it. And that's why Apple's probably got the best claim.
Well,
because they have legal documents that say Radio Shack waived their rights to that data. So...
Well, that's going to be drug out in court for quite a while.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But the assets for Radio Shack were $29.7 million. Do you really think that hedge fund – I mean, that's what the hedge fund paid for it.
Well, sure.
Do you really think – I mean, Apple can – $29.7 million, they can hire every lawyer in the United States and just keep coming at it until all of a sudden it's costing the hedge fund double that money.
Exactly.
And it's not a drop in the bucket to a company like Apple or a company like Google. You know, so in that case, consumer rights are being protected. But I will give another example from Apple, who is a company who's dear to my heart and I love their products. I know you're not a big Apple fan. But the Apple Watch and HealthKit.
Mm-hmm.
I have an Apple Watch coming. I know exactly what it does. It's actually, if it weren't for the fact that I love technology so much, I would probably say no to one. But I just think it's so cool that it's like a personal tricorder that you wear in your wrist. And it can check your blood oxygen level. It can check your – that is just too cool to me. But on the flip side –
So what's happening to that data?
So that data is – I believe you can opt in or out of having that data sent to Apple. Now, I believe that data is protected by Apple, but again, that's at Apple, you know, and you know, it's all covered under a legalese that's 23 pages long and written in, you know, two point font. So I don't know that I will ever read all of what my rights are by giving that up. Right. Now, I'm not really concerned. I don't break the law. I do speak out a little bit against injustice on my podcast, so they could always come back and get me on that. But if it comes to that, you won't be listening to my podcast.
But the other thing about that, though, is that you could be accused of a crime. This goes back to the asset forfeiture thing.
Yeah.
You can be accused of a crime and never be convicted of it.
Yeah, and they can take that data. And they can take your data. Yeah.
Because the data, like the asset, is presumed guilty, and it's covered under a whole different set of rules in the justice system. So it's not as secure as everyone thinks it is.
No, absolutely not. And, you know, and I have not. I will be the first to admit I've been following the civil forfeiture thing, not so much because it's a huge problem here in Ohio, although it potentially could be, because our laws are not nearly as good as the way they are in New Mexico at the moment.
Although I have been pressuring a couple of my state legislator friends, I think we're going to see a bill drop.
Yeah,
soon.
But I've been concerned because Indiana, they abuse the civil forfeiture law quite a bit there.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and there's case after case after case. And frankly, what ends up happening is because to get your property back and prove that even though you were innocent, proven innocent by the state or federal government of whatever you were accused of, will cost you more than just replacing the property by 10x.
There was a case in the East Coast, I forget which state. A hotel owner lost his property because out of the hundreds of thousands of guests his hotel hosted, 30 over a 20-year period were busted for drugs. Law enforcement came in, seized the property. This guy has been out of business for years and has only just now finally recovered his property. And that's happening all over the country.
Yeah.
I can foresee the same thing happening to our data. I can foresee law enforcement. Well, we're already seeing it with like the NSA.
Yeah.
Stealing our phone data and, you know, our phone records and transcripting our calls and our texts and all of that is sitting in a database at the National Security Agency.
Well, and like they're going to give that up either. Oh, yeah, yeah. We're no longer going to collect it.
Right. And I'm
you still got that on tape, right? And the copy that's over here.
Not only are they not going to destroy what they already have, but even if they're told don't do that anymore, that cat is out of the bag.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the federal government. This is what they do. You know, if it can't be the NSA, it'll be some other organization will be spawned to do that. So I don't think that's a... We're going to be surveilled forever.
Well, and the one thing you have to understand is although we have privacy rights and the right to privacy in the United States, most people don't really understand, even if the government and everybody followed them, that some of the things that you think you have as a right are not rights.
Absolutely.
Like one of the things a lot of people – and, you know, people do this all the time and that nobody thinks anything of it. But when they're speaking about the President of the United States, they'll make threats. You know, that's totally illegal. Totally illegal.
Absolutely illegal.
You know?
And, you know, how many times have we heard stories where the Secret Service have shown up?
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, like, hello.
Yeah.
You know?
You're coming with us.
And it's kids.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not even just adults. I mean, this has happened with kids already, too.
Yeah, making a threat online and, You know, there's quite a few things that we consider the rights, and some of them are weird because they're contradictory, like that versus your freedom of speech. But the issue comes in is the fact that if it's perceived as a threat, particularly lately, it's probably 20 years ago. I don't believe people's behavior changes over time.
Yeah, it really doesn't.
20 years ago, people make those threats, but you didn't have the internet, you didn't have Twitter, you didn't have Facebook, you didn't have all these things that now can disseminate it, outside of a small group of people. You know, and so little comments and things like that, which have always been illegal, now become a big deal because it's.
But none of that is permanent.
Correct.
You know, I mean, it's you can't take that back. You think that by deleting that Facebook comment, it's gone. It's not.
No.
You know, it's sitting in a database somewhere.
Yep. You know, and so that's where, you know, the socially innovative social innovation, where they can, you know, and we see it all the time today where they're correlating data, because that's really what social innovation is about, you know. You know, just like you go into Target and you swipe your card, or what's really annoying on Facebook lately is you buy something on Amazon and then all of a sudden you see on Facebook all the ads for what you're buying or looking at.
I was just gonna say, I was playing a game the other day, and it was one of those, you know, like free internet games. So you got the little crazy little ads on there. They, for some reason, had an ad about a lawnmower. And I'm kind of in the market for a lawnmower. So I click on the ad and I check the thing out and it's, okay, it's a little pricey, not really what I want. So the next time I log into Facebook, what is the first ad I see?
That lawnmower ad.
It's that lawnmower.
Yeah.
It's that pervasive. It's very creepy.
Yep.
And I think if you're not really aware of how it all works, it can be perceived to be stalkerish, really.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, and it's going to carry over as I think the next big push in social innovation is in cars, because it's like carrying a laptop or a tablet or a PC around or a phone around. It's something you have with you most of the time. And, you know, as these cars get smarter, and by God, you know, I want GPS integration with my phone, and I want to be able to listen to Spotify and Pandora and all this in my car. The downside of that is that they know where my car is all of the time. Now, for me, I don't really care. You know, the fact that you're going to find out that I go to horse shows every weekend and I drive a big truck and I don't, you know, big deal. But,
and you get crappy gas mileage.
Yeah, I drive a diesel, so I get such crappy gas mileage. But the you know, there are other people who are going to go, man, you know, and some of those people have nothing to hide. But they just, you know, it seems like an invasion of their privacy.
Well, I think that goes back to the stalkerish feel.
Now, what would. So many states have tried to get this is where I think evil can come into it from the particularly from the government.
Yeah.
Is now we don't have it here in Ohio anymore, but we had the e-check, mm-hmm. just like most states do. Maryland has it, Virginia has it. You know, where to get your car licensed, it has to pass a supposed environmental protection check. Yeah. Again, EPA, IRS, two organizations I
can't really do without.
Yeah, exactly. But what that really does is the particularly the e-check does a couple things to society. One, it keeps old vehicles off the road. So you're starting to take these vehicles away that people might be driving that don't have these computerized systems in them to be able to track them easily. So one, we're taking away some technology that does not conform to the fact that we can now follow you and track where you're going and everything else. The other thing it does, unfortunately, is people who do not have the means to buy a brand new vehicle now no longer have a way to have a vehicle, which then becomes job limiting. I mean, it's just...
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
you know, the United States, unfortunately, is not like Europe. Even as much as people say where people are moving to the cities and all this other stuff, and they are. Cities are getting bigger, but as much of the population in the U.S. despises cities as much of them who live in cities.
Well, I don't know that that's necessarily true for Ohio. Now, yeah. It may be true in major metropolitan areas across the country, but I know in Ohio, our biggest cities, the ones that you think of as being our biggest cities, Cincinnati, Cleveland, they've been losing population like you wouldn't believe.
Correct. But Columbus...
Columbus, on the other hand, has actually gained population, but Dayton has lost. No,
absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, Akron, Toledo, they've all been losing population.
But, you know, when you look at that, the other issue you have to look at, too, in that respect, is that in Europe, most countries are the size of most of our small states. Yeah. Not our big states, our small states. You know, so Ohio, California, and Texas, you know, those would be multiple countries in most countries.
And that's why, take commuter rail.
Yeah, that's why it
makes so much more sense in Europe than it does here.
Absolutely.
Here, it makes no sense.
Now, I totally believe not in commuter rail, but I believe in, you know, rail as an alternate transportation to flying or whatever. The problem is, rail today that way, because we have Amtrak, is more expensive than to fly a plane.
Yeah. Although, freight.
Correct.
Does really well on rail.
Yeah.
In fact, it's the only sector of rails business that makes money.
Yep. But, you know, that in the United States makes more sense to me is not just freight, but, you know, people as freight, well, shipping them across.
Passenger rail, transcontinental passenger rail makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But, like here in Ohio,
our
previous governor tried to get funding to run a train from Cincinnati to Dayton to Columbus to Cleveland, which was the dumbest thing ever because you could get in a car and get from Cincinnati to Cleveland in about half the time.
Exactly.
And actually, I would think your carbon footprint would be even smaller as well.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. That I don't understand that concept. And even like if you look at public transportation, one of the things you really have to worry about with it, and we see it here in the United States, we see it really bad in southwestern Ohio and northern Kentucky area, is it's also a way to bust your crime around.
Yeah.
I mean...
It really is.
how many malls in the Dayton area have been destroyed because they bust the crime in? You know, and it's petty crime. It's not like it's...
And, you know, a lot of people will look at the demographics of that and claim it's racial, but it's not what it is.
No.
I mean, it's socioeconomic.
Absolutely.
It's not racial.
Absolutely. You know. And then, you know, but unfortunately in one case, like Beaver Creek, they use the race card to not look at it from a, wait a minute.
Yeah.
You know. What's our socioeconomic issue, and why should we run the bus to that mall as opposed to, but you know that's the other thing is, people here are so opposed to using public transportation, unless they have to, because there's no freedom in it, and that's what
there really isn't.
That's why I don't get any. I don't get this concept of why we're so happy to. I mean, yes, you know, as Albert Einstein said, you know. Technology will always supersede morality by 100 years. I'm paraphrasing, but...
Well, I think we can accept that as an axiom.
Yeah.
And history is pretty much borne that out.
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of the things that we think in these ideas of socially innovative technology just because it's a good idea doesn't mean we should implement it.
Well, and again, I think that goes back to the initial set of questions we asked.
Well, at the top. Here's another a good example, because I'm on both sides of this debate. Uber, that's a social innovation company. That's all they do. So what did Uber do? So Uber saw that there's an issue with public transportation that you pay for, mainly the cab business. And so they wanted to turn that market over, and they did in many demographics. But they did it in such a way that was both – they intentionally looked for loopholes in the law.
Sure. That's what all true innovators do. I mean, that's what entrepreneurs do.
Yeah.
They look for loopholes. They look for a market. They look for something.
And Kansas is a good example, because Uber no longer operates in the entire state of Kansas. Mm-hmm. And I don't – my personal opinion is that although I think it's cool what Uber does, I think they have to follow the rules too, which makes sense. And they did not want to have state background checks on their drivers. I have no issue with that.
No, I don't either. In fact, I think that's one of the things – you know, anytime there's a new service or a new any new sort of innovation, I think there – once it's introduced, there's a little honeymoon period.
Yeah.
And then problems start showing up. Uber has had some trouble with some of their drivers – committing some pretty heinous crimes.
Well, there are multiple drivers who are accused of rape. I mean, if I were a criminal who were looking to be a predator like that, heck, Uber would be my way to go. You know? Uber, Lyft,
any of those.
Because, you know, it circumvents a lot of the protections that are there in society to keep predators from preying on people.
So as a freelance journalist, investigative reporter for several think tanks, most of which are free market and, you know, libertarian leaning, if not conservative, you know, I've looked into a lot of these things over a period of time, and I don't object to a state legislature saying, hey, let's take a look at this and let's make some sense. Background checks for Uber, that makes perfect sense to me.
Absolutely.
Making sure that your customer base is going to get the product that they're promised is, I think, a legitimate function of at least the state legislature.
Absolutely.
I don't know necessarily the federal level, but certainly at the state level, an argument could be made.
Well, you know, the thing that, you know, Uber wants to dismiss is that any kind of service like that, the consumer of that service has a reasonable expectation of protection, that it's going to be safe to operate, you know, that, you know, due diligence has been done on employees. I mean, think of how many jobs to work at McDonald's you got to take a drug test.
Absolutely.
So why can't you take a background check when you're dealing with the public and carrying people around, you know? And it's going to get worse, because there's a new service that's starting up in California, very similar to Lyft and Uber, and it's a chauffeur service to chauffeur kids around. So you get on your app on your phone, somebody shows up, you can authorize people from the service to pick your kids up at the school, chauffeur them to soccer practice. When soccer practice is over, the car picks them up, brings them home, whatever. You know. I don't know anybody who wouldn't go and say, well, wait a minute, are all those drivers background checked? Are they bonded? You know.
Yeah.
Are they insured? Are they?
You don't know.
And so why isn't that expectation for just everybody, as opposed to, you know, oh, they're kids. What? You know?
Yeah, and I know. I totally get that. You know, I think a lot of the – I consider myself a small L libertarian rather than a large L libertarian, because, you know, there's boxes that go along with those little ideologies.
Yeah.
I'm not one that thinks that there's absolutely no role for government to play in our lives. I think that's
I think it's naive to think that way.
Yeah, I do too.
Total chaos, which would be great, means that everybody. I mean, so I had a professor in college. It's interesting. So, at one point, I was going to be a history minor. So I had a lot. I've taken a lot of history classes, and I had a professor over at Wright State University. I think is what you used to say all the time.
Absolutely.
Before I transferred and got a degree from a real school. But he was actually a pretty smart guy. I forget his name. But we were in ancient history, and we were talking about Sparta. And he talked about the reality of, you know, because you had the Spartans, who were the ruling class, and you had the slaves, who outnumbered the ruling class by 20x. Mm-hmm. But the reality of it, he said, was is that in Sparta, everybody was a slave. And that would be the only way chaos would work, is everybody's at the same level. Because even the people who are supposed rulers, their entire job is to keep everybody else under their thumb. So they're a slave to the people who are the slaves, yeah, who are doing all the other. And so there, and even in that case, where they're all slaves essentially, which, by the way, you could make this analogy towards a welfare system, but we won't go into that.
Whole different thing.
Still slavery. but the idea is that nobody has free will. Nobody has passion. Nobody has ideas, because that there can't be any conflict. You know, it's homogeny. And face it.
Well,
and United States was not built on becoming a homogenous society. It was built on being a heterogeneous society.
Exactly. And that's where I think it's – for society or a civilization to survive and thrive, there has to be certain rules.
Yeah.
And it's the establishment of that, you know, that code that – determines whether or not a civilization will make it. How does that apply to our technology argument right now? I think is still to be determined.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. I mean, because nobody's – it's kind of funny. So every – I'm a consultant to the federal government. So there's a CTO in every federal organization. There's usually many of them because everybody likes that title CTO. I'm not quite sure why. It doesn't mean a whole lot anymore. It's been homogenized. but the reality of it is all these guys who are looking at technology are far more focused on the operational aspects of them and not the use of them or the disuse of them, and neither is the Justice Department or Congress, you know, or the Senate or anybody who either interprets or creates law within our country, both state and federal. And part of it, I think, stems from a much bigger issue within the United States, but I think part of it too is because people who are in the technology business, which is a service business, you know, even companies today, if you work for the IT department, your customers are the rest of the company you work for. That's relegated to a completely operational role. So that would be like taking the Army, you know, 1st Infantry in the Army, and who is an operational unit, you know, they're boots on the ground, they do things, but not really worrying about the fact that, you know, okay, you guys, you're trained to kill people, fire rifles, that's your number one thing, so just fire wherever you want to. That's kind of what people are doing with technology today. And some people, and I think to a lot of degree, it has, there's no... there's no concept of that we're doing something wrong. We're trying to make our jobs easier. We're trying to make people's lives easier. But nobody's thinking about the, okay, if I do this, what's the consequence here? You know, we're thinking one step ahead, not five.
Well, and another part of that.
And so then, like the Uber example. Yeah. So it's fine that Uber as an entrepreneur does that. But frankly, we're a couple years too late to have been thinking about legislation that says, hey, you know, if they don't get background checks, you know. Well, you know what I mean?
But then again, that's another one of those things where, okay, yeah, the genie has left the bottle.
Yeah.
But there's more than one bottle. Is what I'm getting at. You know, sure, Uber's done its thing, but what are we going to do with Lyft?
Yeah.
What are we going to do with this third company that hadn't even formed yet? You know, so and that's where I think our state legislatures have a responsibility to at least start having those discussions. I don't necessarily think they need to legislate everything.
Oh, I don't either. But what I think is that they need to be thinking, particularly at the state level, because frankly, most of these issues affect your rights from a state-to-state perspective. You know, and that's where, and it's something that from a federal perspective would be unenforceable. I mean, hence why we have legal prostitution in Nevada, why we have legalized marijuana in Washington and Colorado. I mean, really.
That are all federal offenses.
They're all federal offenses, but by God, you know, what am I going to do? Am I going to park an army in each state and go, are you smoking weed, dude? Where am I going to put them all? Now, that could, all you conspiracy theorists. That's Jade Helm right there, you know. But I don't see that Texas smoking a whole lot of weed because they want to legalize it.
No, if that goes down, that's going to be about something totally different.
Yeah. But, you know, it's just it's incumbent upon the local politicians, whether even from city, state, whatever, to be thinking about these issues and bring them up. And now, federal, I can totally see it. They have a different aspect. The idea of the federal government is not to really rule us internally. That's state, state, local.
Absolutely.
It is their, it's
become that.
Yeah.
But that's, it's not.
You know, their job is supposed to foreign powers, you know, fight wars, you know, mediate between the states. That's about the only thing they really should be involved in that respect. So those state legislators, your state senators, your state congressmen, you know, those guys should really be forward thinking in the sense of, okay, we have companies like Lyft, you know, and I don't believe new legislation has to be created either. There's legislation in place. It's just a matter of saying, look, Lyft or Uber or whoever is a cab company, what are the regulations that we already have in place for people's safety there? They apply here. They do the same job. You know, it's like the whole color of money thing. Well, I've got operational money and I have capital expenditure money, and I can't spend my operational money on capital expenditures, and I can't spend my capital expenditure money on operations, but I don't need to buy anything new. I need to maintain what I got. And I don't have enough money to maintain what I got.
Yeah.
But it's all tax money. It's just one's in this pot, one's in this pot, you know.
Well, and that goes back to the way a lot of the way government regulates themselves.
It correct.
Doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
But you know, that's what I'm saying, though, is it can't be treated that way.
Well, I think in a lot of respects, I think it's interesting that how long we've been into this?
45 minutes.
This is the first time we've mentioned local government.
Yeah.
Out of the entire gamut of leadership, whether you're talking the federal bureaucracy or even the elected politicians at the federal level, state level, it's the local government that really drives how you live every day.
Absolutely. Well, and you know, and I will be the first to admit, of all the government guys who annoy me the most, because frankly, particularly federal guys, it's all abstract.
It really is.
We're so concerned about it, but the reality of it is it's abstract.
And we feel like there's nothing we can do about it anyway.
Correct. But the local guys, you know, they're the ones who, in most of these municipalities, and I know why they did it, I don't have enough police to cover an area, and we have too many speeding violations that are causing accidents here. So let's put in cameras. That was our solution. And that's how it was sold to them.
Sure.
And you got to know at the local level, everybody knows this. You know, speeding tickets are a revenue stream. They make money off speeding tickets because if I make the fine too high, everybody's going to fight it. But if I make the fine high enough but low enough that it's too much of a pain to get a day off work to go fight it in mayor's court, you're not going to fight a local ticket. You know?
Until enough people get that ticket and it becomes a class action lawsuit.
Yeah, but then
which is what happened in one of the suburbs of Cincinnati. Yeah,
but what happens there, though, is it becomes a class action lawsuit, but then it gets – now it's state legislatures involved. Because now they're going, well, wait a minute. Are we going to get a whole bunch of class action lawsuits against all these municipalities who have these cameras?
Well, and I think that's how that initially started was the suburb in Cincinnati got sued, lost in court. And then all of a sudden, the state legislature said, oh, we need to do something about this.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, I think that's a sort of a technology that, you know, once you see that introduced, it doesn't take too long to figure out what's good about it and what's evil about it. And then have that conversation and then balance it out.
Yeah.
My problem with the red light cameras isn't so much that they exist, is that they're so damn pervasive. You know, I mean, they're everywhere.
Yeah.
And
if we put them, you know, the concept is it's like Doritos. You can't have just one. If we put one up to control this intersection, well, it makes sense that if I put them up everywhere, it'll make everything safer, which is not the case.
Exactly.
Statistics have shown that actually red light cameras, particularly if they become so pervasive, actually cause more accidents than they help, because now people stop short.
Absolutely.
You know.
Where they would have gone through that yellow light, now they're stopping.
Yep.
Which is causing, not only is it causing accidents, but it's also causing traffic, which no city really wants.
Correct.
So then what they got to do is widen all the roads.
Which, again, research says that just because you add more lanes to a highway or you widen a road so that you can have more lanes – does not mean that traffic will get any better. I mean,
in fact, in a lot of cases, it gets worse.
Yeah.
You know, it comes down to city planning.
Yeah.
And, you know, in a lot of respects, that genie has also escaped the bottle. You know, a lot of our bigger cities are gridded out, and you get what you get.
Yeah.
The smaller suburbs, I think you might have some flexibility. Yet,
but even then, city planning is – I mean, because I know Ohio so well, I always bring it back up. But I also know Texas fairly well. So you have cities like Houston, which actually have no city planning. You know, and you drive down any given street and there'll be a Toys R Us, a Taco Bell, a strip club, a Kids R Us, a strip club, you know.
So they don't do zoning.
I think they do very minimal zoning today. They didn't do zoning there for a long time. It was, you know, you want to build a business?
Here you go.
Here you go.
Buy the property and off you go.
Yeah.
Okay.
Ohio has some fairly strict zoning laws, but the fact that you can build a subdivision right next to an industrial area, you know, as in backyards back up on an industrial area without some kind of easement or you know, requirement. I mean, there's just so many loopholes about it. And frankly, city engineers, they're not the most talented people in the world. I don't have any city engineers who probably listen to the podcast, so I don't care about saying that. But my experience with city engineers is they're kind of like people who teach college. They're the people who couldn't work it in the real world. most of the time. And they don't plan things well. And one of my best friends, by God, is a traffic engineer. And he's worked for this for cities in Tennessee and in Georgia and in North Carolina. And, you know, we talk about what they're concerned with, what city engineers and traffic, they're concerned with parking lots, and they're concerned with speed bumps and stoplights. And not because where the position of it is, it's like they're concerned with, you know, how it's constructed. You know, which is not really what their job is. Their job is when they go to, you know, to do a zoning review is actually to go, well, does it make sense that I'm going to build the chemical plant next to the milk, the dairy? You know, gee, could there be cross-contamination? You know, did we do an environmental impact study? You know, I don't think a lot of that happens at the city level. I think actually in the suburb city level, I think that happens all the time in big cities because it's much more in your face. You know, there's a lot more people. I mean,
plus, it depends on what you're building too.
Correct.
Yeah, you build a big, you know, department store that's got a different set of construction rules that goes along with that.
Correct. Correct.
But I mean, just to build it, not necessarily, you know, legit regulations. I mean, how you construct a building is different.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, even so, I mean, it just things don't make sense to me the way they have built them, you know, in many, many, many Ohio cities, particularly the suburbs.
But now, what sort of impact would this technology have?
So this is probably where social innovation would help.
At least initially.
You know, smart power. So we can conceivably have better setbacks, better easements, bigger setbacks and easements, because we don't have to worry so much about power transmission and those types of things. Or we have a much better idea of what particularly an industrial business, how much power they're using. So now we can understand, okay, when we're running the power there, we only need to have these many transformers, and we only need to have lines that can do this. Whereas a lot of places today, particularly in industrial areas, they overload the power and the lines and everything else, and it makes it ugly looking, or it makes it dangerous, or, you know, because there's so much of the infrastructure there, they can't build the buildings in certain ways that make more sense.
Right.
You know.
But that can be taken to an extreme, which is what they've done with smart meters.
Correct.
You know, I mean, now they've taken what they've tried to do in industrial areas and apply it to residential areas, and I don't think that works as well, and there are privacy concerns there as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, and some of them don't make sense. Or I don't want to say don't make sense. Some of the privacy concerns, it's because people are doing criminal activities and the smart meters automatically tell you who's doing them. You know, like if I'm growing a whole bunch of weed in my basement and I'm drawing a ton of power because of the
heat lamps, heat, or whatever.
The grow lamp lights, right, that they're using, you know. But I'll give you a good example. Now, this is actually Duke Energy's problem because they're stupid. But I live on a 20-acre farm. We have one power line that comes in, and then that power line goes to the house. It goes to a breaker or a breaker box in the house, and then another line goes from that line to another breaker out in the garage, which has a 220 volt to run all of our welders and everything else we have to have on the farm. And then there is a pole outside that another line that comes off that 220 that's coming into the house and goes into the well house. And then there's a breaker box in there and all the other circuits. So all the lights and everything on the barn, on all three of our barns and all of our outside power go to that but it's 1 meter on the house. So I get these letters from Duke Energy all the time about your 10x your neighbor in power consumption. Really? Does the neighbor have three barns that they have to light? Do they have, you know, to do X and Y? And so that's their comparison.
So my question to that is, who cares?
Well,
is the bill getting paid?
Yes.
The company should be caring about that.
Yeah. You're absolutely correct.
And I think it's the pervasive, stalkerish, creepy letters like that that make people say, I don't want this meter because I just want to pay my bill.
Exactly.
I don't need you to know how much power I'm using beyond
what I need to pay.
What I need to pay. That's the whole purpose behind finding out how much power I'm using is how much do I owe, not finger wagging. You're using too much power.
Or even the comparison. You're using X amount more power than your neighbors are. Well, why? I don't care. You know, did you come out and ask me why? I mean, if you ask
me. Is that the point of the letter, or is it just to scold you?
I don't know what the point of the letter is from them, because I think what they're trying to do is more selfish on their part, because infrastructure, in the case of what used to be Synergy, bought up by Duke Electric, in their case, they don't want to invest in more infrastructure. If I'm using that much power and they can make all the houses and businesses more efficient, then they don't have to expand their infrastructure or make as big an investment in the infrastructure to keep service levels the same. That's why they're sending those letters out.
Well, sure.
But are they keeping track? Absolutely. Where's that data going? I have no idea in hell.
But I guarantee you that if the power grid goes out, they're going to be coming to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's where it gets to be kind of creepy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Because really, it doesn't matter if you're a corporation, a multinational, or any level of government. That's too much power. And I don't mean electricity here.
Yeah.
I mean the genuine application of legitimate political power is when it becomes concentrated, it corrupts.
Yeah.
And it corrupts absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can see getting visited by somebody someday going, you draw 20x more power. And how'd you find out about that? You know?
Well, and what's going to be really creepy is when the generator salesman comes by.
Yeah, well, I've already got Jen, so.
But you get what I'm saying.
Yeah, exactly.
When you log on to Facebook and the first thing you see is an ad for a generator, where'd that come from?
Exactly.
You know, a lot of the things that we're seeing is generated by stuff like that.
Oh, absolutely. Because they sell that data so that, you know, it's just like selling an advertisement on TV. Now, I'll tell you where the next thing will get creepy is with smart TVs, which is another socially innovative technology. What happens when, because so Samsung's already been accused of having the smart camera in their TV and them watching you watch TV. So what happens when they start, you know, because the traditional cable company is going away. TV is going to be IP-based. It's going to be a technology based on you know, IT.
And, I can't wait.
And again, another technology that has some great aspects, but the downside is smart TV watches you watch TV. They look at the wrappers on the food that you're eating. They look at the brands on the clothes you're wearing, and then they start targeting ads directly for you. You know, so instead of getting the Target ad, you get the JCPenney's ad because you wear JCPenney's Stafford t-shirts, you know. Or, you know, what will get really creepy is when your wife gets the Victoria's Secret ad because she's wearing Victoria's Secret underwear.
Because it's now just an x-ray.
Exactly. Either that or
no.
From
a marketing standpoint, that's never really made a whole lot of sense to me, and I'll tell you why. Because
why are you selling to people who've already bought your product?
Exactly. You want a new market. You want new customers. I mean, you want to expand your.
But that's exactly what.
But that's exactly what it's going to do.
Yeah.
I mean, we've already seen how that is going to work with the Facebook thing. I mean, like with the lawnmower for me earlier.
Yeah.
These are totally unrelated things. You know, when I look up something on Amazon and that becomes the next ad I see on Facebook, that's a little creepy to me.
Well, you know, I'm looking up things on Amazon that normal people don't buy, you know, digital video interfaces and things like that. And when those ads start showing up, it's like, you know, it's a targeted ad. It's not like it could be a coincidence at that point.
I mean, it's the exact lawnmower. It's not. I'm not talking about a generic lawnmower.
No, it's the exact
model I was looking at.
Yeah.
That's a little creepy to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But I can see that happening with smart TVs.
Oh, absolutely.
And so
looking around your house, there's Amazon. God love them. Another company I love because I love buying their stuff and it's cheap and I can get it and they bring it to me on Sunday and, you know, awesome. But on the flip side, Jeff Bezos has got some interesting ideas going on in his head, like the buttons that you put in your house and then when you run out of, you know, milk, it adds it to your cart and your Amazon and then it just refill, you know. You know, so on the evil side of me, if somebody ever had those when they secretly weren't looking, I'd be hitting those buttons all the time.
Yeah.
You know, so their grocery bill comes back, it's $1,200.
My friend Tom would come over and, you know, start hitting buttons all over the place, and then I'm $1 million in debt.
Yeah, exactly.
That's where I think that the technology run amok has got, there has to be some level of control to stuff like that.
Well, I don't think we're going to be able to answer it tonight. We may have to come back and revisit this because laptop's at 5%. And we've been talking at this for over an hour. So we want to hear from you guys, our listeners. Let us know what you think about tonight's show. You can email us at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. Or you can visit our website at www.gizmosapiens.com. Go into this episode, which will be episode 103. And leave us a comment regarding this episode. And we will see you on the digital flip side.
You've been listening to Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.